Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell, Editor-in-Chief of Boat International, and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones, our Features Director. Charlotte, why don't you kick us off by telling us a bit more about this week's interviewee?
Sure. Well, this week our US editor, Cecile, interviewed sea-level expert John Englander. And if you recognise his name already, that's because he's written a bestseller before called High Tide on Main Street. And now he's got a new book coming out with a slightly longer title, it has to be said, Moving to Higher Ground, Rising Sea Level and the Path Forward. And it basically grapples with this very thorny, difficult topic by trying to present some really positive and hopeful solutions. So he's an interesting guy. An Englander actually began his career as a diver. He's made more than 5,000 dives and he's done numerous expeditions onshore, on ice and below water. So he definitely knows his stuff. I know he knows what he's talking about and I'm sure he'll be fascinating to listen to.
So sea levels are rising. Is one of his solutions to go out and buy a boat?
I don't know. I haven't heard the interview either, so we'll have to listen. It'll be interesting to see if that's the positive way forward he's suggesting. I doubt it's quite that simple, but yeah.
It's the silver lining, surely.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, how was it last week? You're obviously absent from the podcast.
Yeah, my first absence. So yeah, I was away because I was listening in, or watching in rather, on the judging for the World Superyacht Awards. Usually these take place in some fancy location, but they were virtual, obviously, inevitably, this year. But it was great to have judges calling in from all over the world. And it was 2 days, actually, of a pretty intensive debate and discussion. So the judges, they're sent extensive dossiers, pictures, videos, statements, specs, stats, the works, really, on all the entries. And after 2 days, we finally have our winners, which will be revealed at the ceremony in Monaco on the 5th of September. Be there. You might know one of the things that singles the World Superyacht Awards out is the fact that our judges make personal visits to all the superyachts. Now, in a usual year, they'd probably see, I'd reckon, about 95% of all the yachts. So we, on average, we have about 70 entries a year. And they'd see 95% of those entries. And some boats you just can never get to because they're in Antarctica or something, or getting through the Northwest Passage or in some equally inaccessible place. So, but 95% is a pretty good hit rate. But this year, despite all the difficulties with getting round, travel, COVID, self-isolation, etc., 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 the judges still saw half of all the boats entered, which is phenomenal. Really, they really go above and beyond the judges. So to see half of all entered boats, to make personal inspections of those boats is really incredible. So our eternal thanks to the judges for braving all the restrictions and COVID to tour so many boats. And actually, you can see all the nominees this year on the website now, and we'll put a link in the description.
That is incredible. I'm amazed, like 50%, given that you couldn't really travel anywhere for any of this period. That is amazing. And I know they take it super seriously. But what was the judging like? I always wonder. I know people are always trying to see if I know any insider information. I never do. But were there any categories where there was a clear winner, or are you not even allowed to reveal that?
Well, some were closer than others. And usually when it gets pretty close, the judges like to give commendations. Well, it's funny because I kind of go in and I look at all the categories, and with what I know, I kind of think, oh, well, that's a win, that's a win, that's going to be close, that's a win. You know, sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. And where I am wrong, it's because usually it's something that I don't consider, because I know a lot about superyachts and the superyacht industry, but obviously I don't have the practical knowledge of having owned a superyacht. So I'll think a boat's that's an easy win, right? And then they'll have a conversation and say things like, well, you know, it's quite a long way, the circuitous path from the galley up to the sun deck dining space, so the food's going to be not as warm as it should be. But, you know, it's stuff like that, like crew access part. I can look at a GA and think, okay, well, you know, that could be better arranged or whatever. But they just see certain things that I don't consider. So a boat that I think would be an easy win maybe gets marked down for things like that. So it's enlightening for me, certainly, to kind of just hear these conversations and download all this knowledge. So, you know, when I go on in future and I think, oh, yeah, well, it kind of makes a lot of sense, you know. So it's a great experience, basically.
It's the same thing in the young designers, actually. So many of the designs that really impress me on paper, you get owners and more experienced designers saying, well, no, actually, you know, this one might not look so radical, but the thought that's gone into the detail and the planning of it is what's going to make it an amazing design, you know, when it actually materializes. So always interesting to see the different perspectives, for sure.
I always remember one of my first ever, when I got joined Boat International, one of the first ever interviews I did was with the legend Terry Dizdale. And so we were just in his studio just talking about concepts. And Terry's got a particular dislike for fancy, extreme concepts because, you know, they make good headlines. But he made the point, because we were looking at one actually whilst we were in his studio, not one of his designs, obviously, someone else's quite extreme concept. And he said, well, how are you going to clean the windows? You know, how do you fender this thing? When you're coming into a tight berth in Monaco, you know, how are the crew going to fender this super yacht? And, you know, it made total sense at the time, you know, hearing from this legend of practical design. Of course, you know, how do you fender a super yacht in heavy winds coming into a tight berth in Monaco? It's, you know, and these are the things that don't always come across when you see stories about some futuristic fancy super yacht concept.
Actually, I would love to see some kind of lower maintenance yachts. Loads of crew have got on TikTok recently and half of their videos are with them just endlessly polishing teak. And I know that it looks beautiful, but I can't help but thinking maybe they would have a better of time if there was slightly less teak and chrome to polish. Anyway, future design maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the World Super Yacht Awards. Make sure you have a look at the nominations now on the website. And as mentioned earlier, winners will be revealed on the 5th of September. Meanwhile, in the slightly nearer future, next week, obviously, is World Oceans Day. And we have a whole programme of activities around it. It kicks off on Monday. So I'll be talking, doing an Instagram live with some of the industry's leading names. Peter Lurson, Jonathan Beckett and Andrew Winch will be discussing how the superyacht industry is advancing the green agenda. So this is a four-way Instagram Live. We've never done one before. We've done a one-on-one Instagram Live, but now Instagram lets you do a four-way Instagram Live. So it could go completely disastrously wrong. I guess you'll have to tune in at 4 o'clock.
Definitely worth watching to find out.
Yeah. Watch me screw it up completely on Monday. Then on Tuesday, we'll be releasing a really beautiful short film we've produced featuring some of the key innovators in our sector. Our video editor, Ed Cavendish, has done a spectacular job on that. So that'll be promoted across our website and social channels. Then on Wednesday, we'll be back on Clubhouse with an event you're helming, Charlotte.
Yeah, that's right. So I'll be there, but it's actually being hosted by Lily Barclay, who's the founder of an anti-plastics organisation called Plastic Planet, and she's also a yacht owner herself. And she's got a great panel lined up. There's Jasper Smith, the founder of Oxen, the very cool kind of eco-friendly yachts if you've not seen them. Robert Van Tol, the founder of Water Revolution Foundation, who I think we've mentioned on this podcast before. And hopefully Fiona Morgan, the director of SailGP, amongst quite a few others. So they're going to be looking at if owners and businesses should be focusing on plastics, or if that's just a total waste of time and there are wider issues at play. And if so, what should yacht owners be doing? So I think it will be a very lively, interesting debate. Lily has said she wants to be pretty demanding of her speakers. So it will be interesting to see what people respond. But of course, the great thing about Clubhouse is that anyone can join the room and join the debate. It's so much fun. I love it. And it's free to sign up. Very easy. It's just an app you download on your iPhone. So if you're around on Wednesday, definitely sign up to the app and pop in at 5 p.m. and feel free to ask any questions.
Then on Thursday, leading brokerage house Fraser, their green team, which is a number of their staff, have formed a green team to promote environmental practices across the business and elsewhere. They'll be offering some tips on how superyacht owners and captains can lower the impact of their yachting. And lastly, on Friday, we'll have an oceans-themed podcast for you. We're dragging Sasha Bonser, our editorial director, onto the podcast, and we'll be talking through some oceans theme content, and we've got a great interview lined up for that as well. Again, the whole program of events can be seen on the website, and again, we'll put a link in the description so you can check it out there as well.
So yeah, stay tuned next week and hopefully you can join us for some or all of that. In the meantime, I just wanted to flag up a feature I've been working on this week. I've been loving hearing about all the seriously impressive sound systems that you can now get on your superyacht. I know Stu is a big hip-hop fan, so I can see he's instantly paying more attention. But I love this stuff. I'm a bit of a geek anyway, but this is some seriously cool kit. In fact, I reckon it would be easy to go down a bit of a stereo rabbit hole here and just double the cost of your new boat in no time at all if you got a bit carried away. But here's one of... We've got a big audio piece coming out in August that looks at all the new developments, and they've been tried and tested by our writer Steve May, so he can really speak from first-hand experience what these things actually sound like. But the thing that I was really keen on is this thing called The Island. So Steve described it as something for the owner who wants a fully immersive audio experience with 360-degree sound and butt-wobbling bass that also doubles as luxury seating.
Is that his description?
That's his description. I thought it was quite good. I mean, it sums up what's going to happen when you sit on it, that's for sure. But essentially, it is seating and speakers at the same time. It's like a curved sofa, which is also the speaker. So the 24-channel sound installation literally encircles you with sound when you sink into the cushions. This is great for so many reasons. One of the great things about this, of course, is that you don't have to worry about where to put your speakers because you're sitting on it. So you save a huge amount of space on board, and it's great for things like big screens, kind of outdoor cinemas on deck. He said they've recently done one for a client who's got one of those huge Samsung wall screens, which are very impressive themselves. So you don't have to worry about the size of the speakers or about the audio being in the right place because it's literally all around you. And then the island also rotates, which is pretty cool. So you can watch a movie at night and then just spin the whole thing round to look at the sunset behind you. You don't even have to twist your shoulders if you want to listen to some music facing in the other direction. And there's also, as if you needed anything else, there's also an add-on you can get where you place various bubbles, they're called. They basically look like snow globes without the Father Christmas. But if you place them at various points on the island, it'll glow and play a particular track with really incredible clarity. Apparently, it's just an amazing party trick. It sounds a bit silly, but is incredible to witness in person. Anyway, I think it's seriously cool. I really want one. And it's made by a company called L Acoustics.
So there you go, sound freaks. If you're after some butt-wobbling bass.
Steve's the guy.
Check out that feature. That would be brilliant. Let's have a walk through the headlines. Kick us off, Charlotte.
Yeah, speaking of very expensive boats, a new national flagship replacing the Royal Yacht Britannia is planned by the UK government in a bid to boost British trade and business. The ship, which will cost a reported £200 million, will begin construction next year and is expected to enter service within the next four. The tendering process for the design and construction of the ship, which is intended to reinvigorate UK shipbuilding, will get underway shortly, so keep an eye out for that. And the ship will reflect British design expertise and boast the latest innovations in green technology, the UK government said. It's going to be crewed by the Royal Navy, and the ship's going to embark on six-month itineraries, which might include docking in a country where a prime ministerial visit is taking place, hosting trade fairs, or providing a venue for an international trade summit. Anyway, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who we're seeing every day at the moment, described the new flagship as the first vessel of its kind in the world and said it was a clear and powerful symbol of our commitment to be an active player on the world stage. And this ship will be the successor to the 126-metre Royal Yacht Britannia, I'm sure everyone's familiar with, which was used as Queen Elizabeth II's Royal Yacht from 1954 to 1997, hosting up to 250 guests at a time and crewed by 21 officers and 250 yachtsmen from the Royal Navy. Although the name of the new ship is yet to be announced, reports suggest the vessel will be named after the Duke of Edinburgh, who helped in the design of Britannia.
Is this just a sneaky way for Boris to build himself a superyacht?
I love how it says it may be used by ministerial visits. He's totally booked himself on the first trip to anywhere. Fair enough, I guess.
I think they need to give us a call about this boat because I'm really worried they're going to cock it up and not use the right people. If Boris, if you're listening, we know all the right people, so give us a call. The superyacht design expertise in this country is second to none. So I hope they've tapped a few of those guys and you know, shipbuilding too. There's some real expertise, particularly in the Southwest and elsewhere in this country that I hope they, again, I hope they tap to help build this boat, because left to the Mandarins of Whitehall, I'm a bit worried about the outcome. I've seen a design. I don't know where the design came from, but it was just wrong. So yeah, so please.
Well, you know, you could find Boris Johnson's mobile number on the internet until relatively recently. Maybe you could just drop him a WhatsApp with a few pointers, Stuart. Maybe we could get him on the podcast.
I'll send him a few email addresses. So you've got to give these people a call. You can't get this wrong.
But yeah, I agree. It's an incredible opportunity. So I hope it goes well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Meanwhile, over in Italy, Overmarine's been very busy. They've revealed the Mangusta 165 REV superyacht, inspired by the design of the 1930s sports cars. And they've also launched the first 104 version of the boat. The 165, the 50-metre flagship of the new of the Maxi Open Rev series, was developed by Overmarine's in-house engineering department with designer Igor Lobanov. And boasts an aggressive profile with curved shapes. It looks really cool. As soon as I got this press release, I forwarded it on to Miranda, our news editor, and said, express my desire to see it on the website very, very quickly, because it was very cool. It is very cool. Floor-to-ceiling windows in the saloon ensure an inside-outside connection and a cozy, sophisticated atmosphere. According to the shipyard, plentiful natural light is available via foldable side terraces integrated into the yacht's profile and three skylights in the main saloon. With similar styling, the 104, also penned by Lobanov, is the first model in this new generation of Maxi Open models and can hit a top speed of 35 knots. Yeah, so Overmarine, kind of ignoring the modern vogue for go slow, maximum range explorer yachts, are building some super cool, low profile and very sleek super yachts. They look awesome. Do go check them out. Again, we'll put the link to a story in the description.
Sounds very cool. But going back to explorer yachts, Rossetti Superyachts has launched its first 37-meter explorer superyacht, the RSY 38-meter EXP. Known best for its construction of ocean-going supply vessels, this model represents Rossetti's first venture into superyachting. The yacht was launched in Ravenna and was built to a design by Hydrotech with contemporary styling, tense angular lines, and large windows for taking in views of exotic locations. Berdisso and Caponi, a studio also based in Ravenna, penned the modern interior, which is highlighted with appealing features, including a custom 150-bottle wine cellar that acts as a divider between the guest areas and the owner's cabin.
Thanks, Charlotte. And let's move on with this week's data story. So we're having a look at superyacht deliveries this week, and the effect particularly of COVID on them. So last year was, in the end, actually a pretty decent year for shipyards and the number of superyachts they delivered, despite the impact of the first 5 months of the year, which was significant. And because the numbers for May this year are now in, we can see how we are, you know, this year's shaping up against 2020 and 2019. So let's look at 2019 first of all. In the first 5 months of 2019, there are 139 superyachts delivered 24 metres and over. In the first 5 months of 2020, that number shrank dramatically to 87. And in the first 5 months of 2021, that number is 144. So we're well ahead of, obviously, last year, which was COVID impacted, and ahead of 2019, which is a very good year. The total length for those deliveries in the first 5 months of 2019 was 32.5 metres. In 2020, the average length of superyachts delivered was 32.7 metres, but this year it's jumped 2 metres. The average length of the 144 superyachts delivered so far this year is 34.7 metres. Across every size category, this year has given us more deliveries so far. So that goes from the very smallest. There have been 84 deliveries in the 24 to 30 meter segment, compared to 55 in the same period last year and 81 in 2019. To the very largest, there have been 6 70 meter plus deliveries in the first 5 months of this year. There were 4 in the first 5 months last year and 2 in 2019. So 2021 in a very, very good place for superyacht deliveries so far compared to the last 2 years. The country making most of these deliveries is, unsurprisingly, Italy. They account for 81 of the 144 superyacht deliveries this year. And that's up against 44 in the same period last year and 63 in 2019. So well ahead. Obviously, Italy was heavily impacted in the early part of last year with COVID, with shipyards closing their doors effectively for a period, with the subsequent result that only 44 super yachts were delivered in the first 5 months. That number has jumped this year to 81, and that 81 is well ahead of the 63 in 2019 as well. So yeah, that just goes to show you how well the super yacht industry has bounced back from COVID. Lots of boats being sold on the brokerage market and lots of super yachts being delivered as well. So lots of good news there. And that's all we have for you this week. Now stay tuned for Cecile Gowart's interview with John Englander.
Hello, John. How are you?
Hi, Cecile. Great to be with you. I'm fine.
Thank you. Great to be with you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got interested in climate change and more specifically, sea level rise?
Sure. It's gone back about 50 years now, I hate to say, but starting in college, but when I was a diving instructor at the same time and learning about the ice ages, I discovered under geology that sea level moved up and down about 120 meters, 400 feet, and it did that regularly. And then when I was diving, I actually was thinking about that, I guess, and it planted a seed, but I never really thought I'd do anything with it or it wouldn't be evident in my lifetime. But over the coming decades, I was deeply in the diving business and lived in the Bahamas, but ran a major diving operation and got to do some exciting things like diving into the polar ice cap. And just, I kept thinking about eras when sea level was different, higher or lower. And then by the late 97, I had a magic opportunity, as I think we talked about, that Jacques Cousteau, who was the inventor of scuba diving, I hosted an event in Orlando for the diving industry, and we gave him an award. And he and I spent some time together, several days actually. And that was a magic opportunity. Jacques was then 86 years old. He would be dead in a few months, actually. But we talked about how the world changed in a different perspective. And nobody was better than Jacques Cousteau. And it really put my head in a different place. And on top of that, he hired me as CEO of the Cousteau Society. So I sold my business, and it was just a turning point for me, January 1997. And then I took a group to Greenland when I was running International Sea Keepers. And that's, I think, when you and I met a number of years ago. And not to get ahead of ourselves, I guess, but after the Cousteau adventure and some other things, I was hired by International Sea Keepers in 2004. And ran that for 5 or 6 years. And I took some of them to Greenland.
Okay.
And that was in 2007. And it was my first night in Greenland that I kind of had this vision. Wait a minute, you know, the yachting community should be interested in this, but doesn't understand it, but because it hasn't been explained properly. But all the pieces suddenly came together for me, that from my geology training, from my thousands of dives, I'd been under the polar ice cap and done some pretty neat stuff. But there really was a moment, an epiphany, literally, in just a minute or two, where I said, the oceans are measurably warmer than they've been throughout human history. And that ties in with the industrial era burning fossil fuels, which is not a bad thing by itself, but it's warming the planet. Hmm. And the ice sheets will be less in a warmer world, just like as we're coming out of the natural ice ages, but this is different. And if the ice sheets are less, the ocean will be higher, sea level will be higher.
Yeah.
And if sea level is permanently higher, the shoreline will move inland and real estate will disappear.
Mm.
And I thought, that's a very simple visual concept, you know, story to tell. And since 2007, that became my mission to research and find explanations that anybody could understand and would be hard to refute. So that to help people see the world's going to be different.
Yeah.
The sea is going to be higher. The shoreline is going to be inland. And it's a global challenge.
You chose a quote by Winston Churchill. Would you mind reading it for us?
Sure, pleasure. Yeah, the opening quote of the book in chapter one. Owing to past neglect, in the face of the plainest warnings, we have entered upon a period of danger, the era of procrastination, of half measures, of soothing and baffling expedients, of delays is coming to its close. In its place, we are entering a period of consequences. We cannot avoid this period. We are in it now.
Wow. Why did you choose this quote?
Well, it perfectly speaks to the situation with rising sea level and climate change at this point. And Churchill, of course, was referring to World War II. But along the years, I've tucked away those quotes that I think we all do that kind of speak to us. And in my case, for the last 20 years, they've been about sea level rise. And I just thought that one was wonderfully appropriate. So chapter one.
Yeah. So part of it, obviously, of this quote, goes to the fact that people tend to ignore what's in front of them, which is certainly seems to be the case with our changing ocean environment. How do you cope with people who want to avoid this subject altogether?
You know, there's lots of things we want to avoid. It can be the federal debt. You know, it can be the international tensions between Palestine and Israel or North Korea. There's lots of things we want to avoid. Getting older, I'd like to say, is something we'd like to avoid. We all would like to avoid that. But common sense says it's not healthy to avoid it. Because while we don't want to depress ourselves, the truth is, and take like getting older. It's in some ways a silly example, but in some ways very relevant. We know we're going to get older, and we know where that leads. And hopefully we have a long life and a healthy life. But we have to face it for our kids and grandkids and our legacy and how we leave the world. And we can turn the problem into an opportunity, because when we have a long time to do preparation and to grow at a personal level, we can adapt. And whether that be planning for our loved ones when we're gone by insurance or estate planning or assets and whatever. But with sea level, it's not going to all happen in our lifetime. This is the beginning of a multi-century change to the planet. Okay. So while we can avoid it and we can ignore it, the truth is thinking about it and beginning adaptation is the smart thing to do. And if we started early, just like taking care of ourselves with what we eat and exercise and all the things we like to do to keep ourselves healthy, we can adapt gradually or more in advance rather than waiting for the crisis when something happens suddenly and unexpectedly.
So obviously your book has a lot of messages that are hard to digest, which is probably goes to our tendency to want to avoid these hard stories. But what is great about it is that you speak in very common words that everybody can understand, and you also pick some very interesting stories to illustrate your points. One of the ones that I really enjoyed and I didn't know about was something you said about the Titanic. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Or
sure. No, it's a great analogy. In the first book, came out in 2012, High Tide on Main Street, I use the Titanic in the first chapter as a metaphor, because everybody knows the story of the ship coming out of the fog bank and suddenly seeing an iceberg that it was in its path. And that's a famous story that everybody knows, I think. And I use that. I said, we had several options. And the Titanic was just a metaphor. We could party in the face of danger, you know, saying, c'est la vie, let's party on. And enjoy life for however long. We can prepare for impact. We can say who's responsible. We can say, you know, how did this happen, and spend a lot of time in that. Or we can think about what do we do after impact, planning ahead. All of those would be reasonable approaches if you were on the Titanic. And here we are on a ship, the spaceship Earth, and sea level is going to rise. And in researching the new book, Moving to Higher Ground, which just came out in April, as you said, I came across a fact in my research that was just stunning. It turns out there was another option for the captain of the Titanic, and it was very well researched. It was done in a study by the Royal Institute of Naval Architects in London and the Irish shipbuilder that built the Titanic. And with an exhaustive study, they actually came up with a way that the captain could have prevented the ship from sinking. Wow. And I won't divulge that. Your readers will have to look in the book. But it is a fascinating tale and highly documented that all the people on the Titanic could have been saved if the captain had had the information and been willing to make a very tough decision.
All right. And why did you choose this story to illustrate your point? What were you trying to say here?
Because I think that's the case with sea level rise. We, for 6,000 years, here's the basic facts that for your listeners. For 6,000 years, sea level has been pretty stable.
Right.
The reason is we were coming out of the last ice age 20,000 years ago, and as the world warmed naturally, and the ice melted and the sea rose 120 meters, it got to the normal high point of this oscillation between the ice ages with sea level rising up and down 120 meters, 400 feet. The reason it was fairly flat was because we were about to enter the cooling period when the ice sheets would have started growing and the sea level would have been falling for 80,000 years.
Hmm.
So by looking at the big picture and saying the world is warmer, the ice sheets are going to melt, whether we like it or not. We should try and slow it. If we see the big picture, we may be able to do something different.
Makes sense.
Right.
What are some of the most common misconceptions about climate change and sea level rise that you encounter?
Well, again, it starts with people who say there's no evidence of it. And the temperature records going back to 1850 are pretty clear that the planet is, particularly the oceans. The oceans, because it takes a lot more heat to warm water than air, so the oceans are a better measuring point for temperature than air, because they're so much denser, and more like a heat battery, if you will, like a hot rock, the seawater compared to the air. So we know from ocean measurements, and particularly in the last 30 years with satellite measurements, which are consistent and, you know, done just in a standardized way globally every day, it's even clearer. But we know that the world is 1 degree Celsius, almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it was a few hundred years ago. So with that clarity that the world is warmer, and we associate that now with trapping carbon dioxide, trapping more heat in the atmosphere, which again was identified in 1859, demonstrated at the Royal Society in London. There's no dispute. It's an easy experiment to run to prove that carbon dioxide does trap heat, and our carbon dioxide levels have gone to 415 parts per million, 0.004%, but that's significant because historically, going back millions of years, CO2 is between 180 and 280, and now it's at 415. It's 40% higher.
Wow.
than in millions of years, and that does correlate with a warmer world. Now, there's cooler periods, and we've had medieval warm periods and the little ice ages and so on, but those are small variations compared to the ice age cycles with sea level moving up and down 120 meters. As temperature moves up and down an average of 5 degrees Celsius or 9 Fahrenheit with the ice ages. So we really have the scientific data. And when we put that together and we get away from the politics and what we'd like to have happen or we don't want to have happen, and we just look at it analytically, the picture's very clear. The world did have a natural cooling and heating cycle. We think of it as the ice ages. It's been going on for 2.5 million years. Generally, about every 100,000 years was an ice age cycle, a natural cause. But now we know that we've changed things. We're in the Anthropocene, the era that's affected by humans, as opposed to the Holocene in the geologic era. So just like going to your doctor and getting a detailed analysis, whether it be the pandemic or cancer or whatever, you know, we would tend to listen to the doctor and not know how they derived at that information, the medical technology. But this is the same kind of thing. You know, you have to go to an expert and listen to what they say. The fact that you say, well, I live in this place and I haven't seen sea level rise. Well, presently sea level is rising at 6 millimeters a year, about 1/4 of an inch. You can't see that.
No.
It's the acceleration. It's the fact that last century it was 1.7 millimeters a year average. Then it was 3, now it's 5. That's a tripling of rate. It's that acceleration that's the problem. Just like with the pandemic, a year ago, somebody could say, well, not that many people are dying. But the experts said, yeah, but it could go to exponential growth and you could have millions of people dying. And that happened. So it's looking analytically or objectively, I should say, at the data, aside from what we'd like to have happen, and realizing that sea level changed naturally, this time we've triggered it, we need to deal with it as soon as possible.
Hmm. Yeah. What are some of the key facts, like how much and over what time frame? I know in your book you do say that it's hard to really give precise figures, or you know, there's give and take. I mean, it's modeling, so it cannot be totally 100%.
Right. So let's deal with both sides of that. But thank you. That was a great intro, and you're right. Whether it be pandemic models or labor models or unemployment models or stock market models or earthquake models, models are models. They're scenarios that look at how different variables affect things, but models are not predictions for any of those things. And it's going to change depending on how warm the planet gets. And we don't know how we're going to make our energy yet, whether we're going to burn all the fossil fuels or we're going to get off them and use nuclear or go to all renewables. We don't know that. But based upon what we do know, the projections are that sea level rise will accelerate. In fact, that's inevitable because the planet's so much warmer. The extra degree Celsius is significant. And we're debating whether to try and hold it to another degree, that 2-degree barrier that you hear about, Celsius. Because we are already warmer, we know that sea level will continue to rise because the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are melting faster and faster. And the heat dynamics, the physics are really simple. There's an acceleration to that. And the models tend to understate. But to answer your question, what do I think is going to happen based upon what I know and having studied this for decades? We're going to have meters of sea level rise in the next 100 years.
Wow.
Whether we have a meter, we'd be very lucky if we did everything right. I don't think that's possible, though. I think that ship has left the dock. I think we're into the 2 or 3 meter category, and if we really don't try and slow the warming, it could be worse than that.
No.
But it's not linear. You can't just divide it out. It's an accelerating curve, just like when the pandemic got out of control. Things happened pretty quickly, exponential growth. I think that if, as a planning guidance, if we think that by mid-century, 30 years from now, we could have a 0.5 meter, you know, it's 1.5 feet. That's probably a good planning horizon. It could be a little bit worse, but it's the second half of the century that where it really accelerates and amplifies. And that's where we're looking at 2 or 3 meters. So, you know, or 5 to 10 feet. But what we don't think of, even with those scary numbers, when you think about it, is it's not going to stop in the year 2100. In fact, it's going to be accelerating. The smart thing to do is to actually plan for higher, because even if we designed a house that we wanted to leave to our grandkids in 100 years or great-grandkids or something, and we plan for 2 meters, 7 feet, you know, why not plan for 3 meters? Make it 10 feet, because the water will get there eventually. So, I mean, this is a different way of thinking about the Earth. But when we think about the Earth and the ice sheets, it means thinking about the coastline.
Right.
And we think about the coastline, we think about cities and islands that boaters, you know, or yachters are very attuned to. I mean, the yachts will float, right?
Yes.
That's the good news. But it's the port, it's where the ports and the shipyards and the marinas and the cities are around the world.
No, it's not just a problem like Miami. You and I both happen to live in South Florida, so I think we're maybe a little bit more keen to tune to this issue. But what are some of the world's big capitals that will be affected in coming years?
Yeah, it's all over the world. Let's go through them, for example. I mean, Washington, D.C. is on a tidal river. We don't think of it, but it's on the Potomac. It floods already during extreme high tides. New York, we saw what happened during Sandy, not a capital, but in some ways a capital of the world. San Francisco is already having flooding during king tide events. Go up the coast to Seattle or Vancouver, okay? It's happening. They're seeing flooding on the Thames River, capital of the UK. Not as bad as Hull, one of the smaller ports up to the north, but the Thames River barrier needs to be redesigned. It's being exceeded by sea level rise, that famous gates on the Thames that were built after the flood of 1953. The Netherlands, of course, is an obvious example for something under threat, trying to design for it, but realizing better than most where this is headed, and it's threatening. But around the world, from Shanghai, one of the world's top ports, to Mumbai or Calcutta in India, to Bangladesh or Vietnam, where there's tens of millions of people that even 30 centimeters, a foot of sea level rise, would put out of their homes. This is a global issue. People think it's a Miami problem. And you and I, we go to Miami because we don't live far from it. But and Miami has a problem, but so does Fort Lauderdale. Right. So does Tampa. So does Jacksonville, by the way, which flooded and demonstrated that in a hurricane a couple of years ago. But it's 10,000 coastal cities. It's not just Florida. It's New Orleans and Mobile and Galveston. It's Charleston and Savannah and Annapolis and Baltimore and Boston. It's every coastal city.
Yeah. Well, you make another really good point in the book. You're talking about some of the massive projects, such and even very remote ideas, pie in the sky kind of solutions, including a barrier on the Baltic Sea. But you do point out that governments alone will not be able to cope with this. And you make the very interesting remark that preparing is up to all of us. So in our small world of the yachting community, what can people do to prepare?
Well, obviously yacht owners have to look at where they're going to dock their boat, whether it's behind their house on a canal or, using a marina or a port of call and a shipyard for maintenance and things like that. But over the course of the next 10 years, sea level is not going to be much higher. I mean, if it's a few inches higher, 10 centimeters, okay, but that's not really the problem. But it's planning for the future, and where that comes into impact is that property values are going to be affected long before the water arrives. In other words, I like to say, I think it was in the first book when I said, property values will go underwater before the property does. And the reason is, as people see the trend of more flooding during king tide events, what we call blue sky flooding here in Florida, just when it's an extreme high tide, streets flood that didn't used to flood. And it's not a storm and it's not even rainfall. It's just an extreme high tide. And that's higher because sea level's higher, creeping up inch by inch, or centimeter by centimeter. And so we've got to see the trend, because what's happening is people in their own neighborhoods are noticing that the flooding's getting worse, even without the storms, that the tides are getting higher, even though they follow this peculiar daily, monthly, and annual, and then 19-year cycle. But people who lived in a neighborhood for 20 years or more are noticing that the highest high tide keeps getting higher. And that's because sea level is getting higher, like a drip filling the bucket, which raises the tide heights as well as the other water levels. And so we're seeing that. And what happens is people are noticing the water is getting closer to their property. And even if the water is not there yet, it's known in the neighborhood. And when they try and go and sell that house, the fact that Los Olas flooded or some other street flooded in clear blue weather makes people wonder how long before my property floods. So it's affecting property values now, even though that property may not be going underwater. So that's what's forcing us to start to think about where is this headed.
Right.
To your other point that you said about my recommendation that this is not just a government thing. I'm glad you picked up on that, because we have this mentality that if there's a problem, the government's got to fix it. And by many people. And many people in yachting who have some means probably would push back on that and say the government shouldn't be always telling us what to do. And part of me agrees with that. And I like to put it that you can't wait for the government to solve sea level rise, because one is the government can't stop it either. Now, they may be able to slow it with the right policies about switching to electric vehicles and renewable energy and so on. And I think that would be great. But regardless, we're going to have sea level rise. Mm. And we can't stop that. We can prepare for it. But the first step to preparation, besides looking at your assets, your house, your shipyard, you know, your marina or whatever, which might be relevant to the yacht owner, the first step is understanding the problem. What your listeners are doing at this very moment, by having listened to me for 20 minutes with you, they're getting educated. They may not like some of the information, but they're open-minded listening, and hopefully they'll read my book. But they're recognizing that maybe there's a chance that sea level rise is going to happen, even if we do all the right environmental things. And if that's the reality of the future, the sooner I can see that, there's opportunity. But the first thing is to see the truth. And that starts with just reading a book, reading an article, doing some research on the internet, whatever, not listening to the same old tropes that say, oh, you know, that this is made up, it's a fictional thing, that sea level's not rising. Every coastal community has seen the water get higher and higher. The flood days are getting worse. Mm-hmm. We can deny things because we're humans, we're emotional, or we can be really insightful and see ahead into the future and react ahead of time. And this one calls it for us to do that. And it just starts with understanding the truth yourself. And if you believe, once you see the truth, teaching others, because that's how the world will change.
Last year I was in the Great Lakes and I couldn't help but notice that the marina where we were was having some significant flooding issues. The shore power plugs were under the water, the pump out, the fresh water access, everything was below water. And I'm thinking, oh, that's it. That's the sea level rise. And actually, that has nothing to do with it. This is, you explain better, but the Great Lakes are far above the sea. So what was that about?
Yeah, no, great. There's several lessons there. So thank you for bringing that up. The Great Lakes, as you say, the five Great Lakes, which hold 20% of the world's fresh water, they range from 250 or about 80 meters above sea level up to three times that, 650 feet above sea level. They seem like mini oceans, but they're well above sea level. Interestingly, the Great Lakes are only 10,000 years old. They were created by the last ice age in retreat 10,000 years ago. And effectively, those little 300 foot deep, 100 meter holes in the ground were just gouge marks by the ice age, and gives you a sense of the power of ice to reshape the landforms. So Long Island and Cape Cod and the Great Lakes all were created by the retreat of the glaciers 10 or 11,000 years ago. That gives you a sense of the power of what we're talking about that's happening now as the bigger glaciers in Antarctica and Greenland melt and recede. But to your question about water height, so the Great Lakes are isolated from ocean height by the canals, the locks, the dozen or so locks that you have to go from the Atlantic up to get to Lake Erie, that the water height you're seeing is because of more rainfall. And lake levels will either go down because of we're drawing out too much groundwater, which is happening in many places in the world, but we're getting more rainfall because the oceans are warmer and they're evaporating more. That's why we're getting this record rainfall and snowfall, by the way. And it seems counterintuitive because we're getting it at the same time we're getting more drought. But in a warmer planet, you're going to get more extreme temperatures and you're going to get more rain and more drought, or more precipitation and more drought. And in certain lakes, depending upon the weather patterns and just luck of weather, you know, California's had years of drought and then they have this atmospheric river that deluges California. Well, it's the same thing that's affecting lake levels. So like Lake Ontario, when I was up there last year in Toronto giving a talk, they observed that it was about 30 centimeters a foot higher than normal. But again, it was from rainwater getting into the lake. And so it's lake by lake, and some will be lower because of evaporation or drawing out the groundwater. Some will be higher because of more rainfall. And the other effect that affects lakes in certain parts of the world is glaciers up in the mountains, whether it be the Sierra Nevada, the Sierras of Canada and the U.S., or in Asia, the giant glaciers from the Himalayas that supply water and irrigation for agriculture to China and most of Asia, just as California is fed by the glaciers of the Sierra Nevada. So as the glaciers melt, we're getting more rainfall, more water downstream, but the glaciers are shrinking quickly. So sometime in this century, many of them will disappear. Mm-hmm. So again, confusing, because we're seeing more water and then we're going to see less water.
Right. Yeah. Well, there is no doubt that the messages in your book are a little bit tough to digest, but you put it very very well. You do tell stories. We understand what's going on. And through it all, you keep a very positive and hopeful tone. So how do you manage to do that?
Well, I think it was Winston Churchill, back to that other quote. He said something, I'm an optimist because I don't see much benefit in being anything else. I think it was him, but I may be wrong about that one. But we have to have hope in the future. If we have kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews or just concerned about how we leave the earth as a legacy, we have to try and do better. And humans are ingenious. And it's often been said that, you know, we show our best when we're put to the test, you know, that when it's only when we really are backed into a corner or burn the bridges behind us that we'll figure out, you know, what to do. And I like to think that applies here.
Well, I think that's the key messages in your book. And John, thank you so very much for your time. And again, the book name is Moving to Higher Ground, and by John Englander.
Thanks for listening to this week's Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by Grace Nielsen and is a production of Boat International Media. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next week.